one last look at that question for background and just confirm that it looks like, in terms of Mercury projects that you may have been involved in, about 92% of you have worked with mercury contamination in the past. Almost three-quarters of you have worked with mercury speciation and methylation. And then just over 60% of the audience has also dealt with mercury accumulation in the food web. So we do thank you very much for participating in that quick background poll that will hopefully help guide our instructors as they walk through materials. With that, let me turn things over to Michelle Mahoney, who will be serving as my co-moderator. Michelle?
Great. Thank you very much, Jean. Appreciate you orienting us on our webinar for today. I'm very excited to present our topic on identifying the potential for methylation of mercury at mining sites. This is part of our ongoing series of webinars related to mining cleanup topics on Cleveland.org. As Jean mentioned, it is sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. We will have three presenters today. Our first will be Chris Cora, who is an RPM in Region 10, and he's the RPM for the Formosa mine, of which Steve Dent is going to present the work that he's been doing at that site. And then we'll have Todd Luxton, who's with EPA's ORD, talk about some work that he's been doing at the near the Black Butte mine site. So with that, I think I want to encourage everyone to keep submitting your questions as the presenters are giving you their information, and we will be taking breaks in between each presentation to answer those questions, and then anything we don't get to, hopefully there'll be some time at the end of the webinar to address those. So with that, I think I'd like to turn a kickoff webinar over to Chris Cora.
Thank you, Michelle. Well, once this thing loads up, I'm happy to introduce Steve and Todd, who really are doing the substantive parts of the discussion today. I'm the project manager for Formosa. I'm not as familiar with Black Butte, but it's in our region. It's only about 50 to 75 miles north of Formosa site. And I'm having trouble with, oh, okay, here we go. And they're basically in the same mountain range. The Formosa mine was a massive sulfide deposit where they mined zinc and copper. And the Black Butte is a cinnabar deposit that was mined since the 1890s to the late 60s. They're both underground mines. Black Butte, the significant part there was they had a furnace and they did extract liquid mercury out of the tailings, and they dumped the tailings in the rivers. So there's very high concentrations of mercury in the sediment load, and the obviously, the issue here is there's very high mercury going into a reservoir that is different than what we have at Black Butte, at Formosa. How come my thing's not changing? I can't get the slides to progress. Oh, okay, here we go. This is Formosa, a little different mine, mostly copper and zinc, very, very high sulfur concentrations in the ore body. Basically, we have, it's a one-third sulfur. So we're having incredible acid rock drainage coming out of this site. And you can see in the photos, the precipitates make the water very brightly colored. We have nice blues, oranges, whites coming out of it. The pH coming out of the mine is around 2. And very significant metal loading into these creeks. The main factors for methylation of mercury require microbial activity, and you'll see that the two sites, this is kind of the main difference in them. Well, one, we have very low mercury in Formosa. However, when we were doing our treatability testing and some column work and field work in testing out bioreactors, we were concerned that we could convert that into methylmercury. So we ended up doing ultra-low methylmercury analysis. And the issue for us was, even though we have very our total mercury concentrations are pretty consistent with national averages, about 3 nanograms per liter, and compared to Black Butte, which was tremendously higher, I mean, 5 orders of magnitude greater, that, but we could still, because we had very low pH and we were introducing bacteria, that sulfur-reducing bacteria that could convert the mercury into methyl mercury, we were concerned that if we did do the water treatment plants that we were looking at, it could actually exacerbate a problem that we didn't have previously. So, and as you'll see, well, next slide, this is the average mercury in rivers in the United States. Total mercury is in the middle row, all sites. You know, where Formosa was more consistent with unmined sites, even though it was a mined site. But methylmercury is relatively low concentration, but it doesn't take a lot to cause a big problem. And here's a good example of the different, well, not conceptual site model, but the reasons why Formosa versus Black Butte is not a problem. I mean, Formosa is not really a mercury problem because we have very aerobic conditions. They're high-order streams, very low organic carbon in them, very aerated versus Black Butte, which is basically all the tailings and the mercury are being deposited into a reservoir that is man-made and basically goes anoxic, and it leads the production of methylmercury. And with that, I think we go on to Steve for his presentation, and that was just a brief intro. Thank you.
Okay. A screen is populating here. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us on this Clue-In webinar. I think these discussion topics on these Clue-In webinars are a good opportunity for people to get experience from these treatability studies and other investigations on the kind of squirrely dynamics that mercury expresses in the natural environment. I mean, it's one of those tough nuts to crack that just when you think you have it dialed in, it throws you another monkey wrench in your gears and throws you through a loop. So what I'm going to be talking about is as Chris introduced, an evaluation of mercury patent transport in a mining influence water treatment system that harnesses sulfate reduction biochemical reactors to treat the mine-influenced waters. And this is a talk that what I want people to think about in looking at the poll at the beginning, there's, you know, about 40% of the folks that are joining us today have not really dealt with mercury accumulation in the food web. And it's a different topic to look at mercury accumulation in the food web than, say, other drinking water and exposure issues, because the concentrations that impact that in the natural environment are extremely low. And so what I want everyone to try to get out of this as we walk through this is an understanding and an appreciation for the trace mercury analysis that are required to do this type of work in evaluating the impact on the food web. So what I'm going to start with is a little bit of a background on mercury in the environment. I'm seeing if my cursor's just disappeared on me. There it is. Okay. There it is. Talk a little bit about mercury advisories that are around the United States, food web interactions with mercury, and the importance of trace mercury analysis in this type of investigation. And then we'll get into the actual treatability studies performed at Formosa, the mine site where we actually had it on site and operating, as well as a sister study at the Office of Research and Development over at the EPA's lab over in Cincinnati, where they conducted a benchtop study of the same water with similar configurations in column tests, and then go into several general conclusions and some recommendations. So to start out with the background, mercury really came on the scene in the 60s as an environmental issue in Minamata Bay, Japan. This is one of the biggest first recognized areas where significant mercury contamination led to widespread impacts on the population. This was an acetaldehyde production facility that operated from 1932 to 1968. Over the course of that period, they dropped 27 tons of methylmercury into the bay. And typically when we look at industrial sites, we're thinking of inorganic mercury, HG2+, or elemental mercury, liquid mercury that evaporates and enters the atmosphere. But this was already methylated mercury that they're dumping into the bay. And just to put a note on it, methylmercury is the form that will bioaccumulate in the food web. So normally when you dump, say, inorganic mercury into the water, it has to go through some sort of natural process to be converted to that bioavailable form. And because this was already methylated, it immediately started rising in the food web to concerning levels. First case of actual mercury poisoning was identified in 1956. Over the course of this this catastrophe, over 900 people were killed from consumption of mercury-contaminated fish, and over 2 million were impacted with severe health effects. So it's kind of like the love canal of the mercury world. In the United States, we basically have mercury consumption advisories in every state. Any water body where they found fish over 300 parts per billion or 0.3 parts per million, they'll put a fish advisory up to limit the consumption of that fish and put advisories for, say, for example, pregnant women that are more susceptible to mercury contamination. The blue states here are states that have issued a statewide mercury advisory. Basically, they've gone around and seen enough lakes with fish over the consumption guideline. The statistics are strong enough that they just put a blanket consumption advisory out there, just thinking that it's likely that you're going to run into mercury in fish above the consumption guideline in any particular lake. And then the yellow or tan states, you have more of a water body specific where they've gone around and tried to identify the specific water bodies that seem to be a problem. The USGS, about 10 years ago, went around and looked at 367 streams in both impacted basins and unimpacted basins. And we say impacted, for this study, they're referring to basins that are impacted by historic gold or cinnabar mining. The cinnabar, they are actively mining mercury. And in gold mining, historically, they used liquid mercury to bind and amalgamate gold while they were mining and helped them extract the gold. So a lot of these historic gold sites have pretty significant mercury contamination associated with them. And so they went out and looked at all these streams, and the you can see on the figure here, the orange or the purple dots are the impacted sites, and the dark blue dots are the basins that were unimpacted. This is stream water. And 25% of all streams they looked at found fish over the consumption guideline of 0.3 micrograms per gram or milligrams per kilogram or part per million. All of those mean the same thing. And then double the consumption guideline, over 10% of the streams they removed fish from were above double the consumption guideline. So it's pretty widespread. But I also like you to notice that it's a pretty even distribution. So just because you have mercury contamination doesn't mean it's been methylated and is in proximity to accumulate up the food web. And so there is a pretty even distribution between unmined and mined basins. And I just lost connection to the presentation. It's kicking back on.
Okay.
There it goes. Okay, we're back. Okay, so how mercury in the environment becomes a problem with the food web, you have a mine, say, for example, that's releasing labile inorganic mercury into the system. I can get my cursor. Where's that? There it goes. So labile mercury, when we say labile, we're referring to easily available, not too heavily complex, ready to react in a chemical or biological reaction. Oftentimes, in a mining situation, you'll have a lot of electron acceptors being released as well, like sulfate, iron. And then when that is delivered to an area with a good carbon source and reducing conditions, sulfate-reducing bacteria can convert that inorganic mercury to methylmercury. And if that methylmercury is generated and accumulates in an area that's in a close proximity to the base of the food web, and there is a lack of competing ligands that bind to methylmercury, meaning it's available to accumulate onto, say, algae, we start entering the food web. And so this little drawing here kind of illustrates that and how that biomagnifies. And there is a lot of caveats and examples where this doesn't really hold, but in general, we typically see from water concentrations to algae, generally a 100,000-time-fold increase of mercury enrichment between the two phases there. And then a smaller increase between the different trophic phases, but generally 2 to 5 times between algae and zooplankton increase, and 2 to 5 time increase between zooplankton and prey fish or planktivorous fish, and then another 2 to 5 time increase between planktivorous fish and predator fish or piscivorous fish. And what that translates to as far as what kind of concentrations we're concerned about in the water column, we're going to take this and kind of reverse engineer it and work the problem backwards. If we start at 300 parts per billion or 0.3 parts per million, which is the fish consumption guideline, and we look at a piscivorous fish, they're the most likely to have that concentration because they're at the top end of the food web in these aquatic systems. Well, you take the 300 and you take that 2 to 5 time increase and work it backwards, that gives you a range of planktivorous fish around 60 to 150 parts per billion. Down to zooplankton, that gives you a range of around 12 to 75 parts per billion. Work it back to algae, that translates to about 2.4 to 37.5 parts per billion. And then with that big jump of 100,000 times, we end up with concentrations in the water that could potentially lead to the fish consumption guideline of 0.024 part per trillion to 0.375 part per trillion. That's nanograms per liter. So these very trace levels are what we're working with when we're trying to identify and resolve mercury accumulation issues in the food web. And you can see that this is definitely a good argument to do the trace techniques. But when we're doing the trace techniques, and I, sometimes when I go to conferences and I talk to people that have been working in the mining industry, my arrow to advanced slides is not working. Oh, that's because I didn't finish the animation. Okay. They wonder what, how accurate these trace mercury analytical techniques are. And I'll get to that in just a moment. I want to also run through the study that Chris was showing some numbers from is this USGS study evaluating total mercury in these mining impacted and unimpacted streams. And you can see here through the distribution that we have much more of the purple, the gold and cinnabar mining, historic mining sites have impacted basins. You can see much more influence with the total mercury in these systems than in these lower concentrations where it's more of an even distribution. Where Formosa, what we're about to get into, falls, like Chris said, it falls kind of in the middle of that population and the national average of total mercury concentrations in the water column. Methylmercury-wise, it's more of an even distribution again because, again, those mine sites are going to be kicking off inorganic mercury, whereas methylmercury has to find the right environment to become methylated. And as Chris pointed out, in a lot of these mining areas with high-energy streams, you have a lot of oxygen present, and you're not necessarily fostering anaerobic conditions that can lead to mercury methylation. So it's more of an even distribution between impacted and unimpacted sites. This distribution would change if they went all the way down to, say, a receiving water body, like a reservoir or a lake, where this ended up in those deposits, found more quiescent conditions. And you can see here, Formosa is on the low end of methylmercury for these sites. This red line actually indicates the detection limit for this study, so we're probably more in this lower end down here. So as far as what kind of techniques to employ to get to these concentrations that seem kind of ridiculously low, as EPA methods 1630 and 1631 for trace methylmercury and trace total mercury. The detection limits that are commercially available are 0.03 nanograms per liter for total mercury, and then for methylmercury we have 0.002 nanograms per liter. A lot of labs that specialize in this can actually get well below this, but we're talking, you know, 2 picograms per liter. And a question that I get quite a lot when I'm presenting work like this is that even real? I mean, can we look at those values and compare 1 nanogram per liter to 5 nanograms per liter? Are they functionally the same? And the answer is you can depend on these analyses, especially if they're collected appropriately. But these labs have really dialed into the technique that, and they have to follow the same kind of QAQC protocols, you know, with the duplicates and the spikes and the blanks. And they have very good repeatability. Where the weakness of these types of analyses is in the sample collection. And their specialty techniques for collecting trace mercury samples oftentimes requires training and experience to get it right, because it's very easy to contaminate a sample when you're collecting it, when you're dealing with very tiny trace amounts of mercury in that sample. But it's a requirement if you're going to look at the base of the food web, as we've seen. So let's get into our treatability study at Formosa, looking at these biochemical reactors to treat the mine-influenced waters that are coming out of an adit there. We're going to take a look at the treatment configuration and setup and the mercury assessment results. So Formosa mine impacted water here, you can see that it's, you know, pretty significant in its metals contamination. As Chris mentioned, its pH of 2 sometimes goes up to a pH of 3. I believe the period of time that we evaluated, it was up into the low 3s. You can see really high in copper and iron, manganese, and zinc. And it was at one time a copper and zinc mine. So what is a BCR? A biochemical reactor is an engineered system that relies on organic substrate to drive microbial reactions and chemical reactions to reduce concentrations of metals, acidity, and sulfate in a system. Reactors that we employed in this study that I'm presenting here, there was one system that we used, a successive alkalinity producing system. We called it a SAPS. It was only for pretreatment, and it was designed to raise the pH before entering our BCR barrels, and it was only used on a couple sets of our barrels. We have a Kytorem mix, an SC20 blend with sand and gravel, and this is a blend of calcium carbonate, protein, and processed ground-up crab shells. And then we have a woody substrate manure-inducing or manure BCR that includes limestone. And basically what we're trying to do is harness this reaction here, is the reduction, microbial reduction of sulfate to sulfide, and then the reaction of sulfide with reduced metals to form a precipitate and settle out as a solid within the barrels, reducing the metals in reduced form rather than having to oxidize them downstream and get them to precipitate out that way. The configuration that we employed was we have this adit water source, and then we had a series of 6 BCRs. 3 of them were the wood manure matrix that we spoke about, and then the SC20 chitin sand blend. And the first 2 pair were, they received raw mine-influenced water. The second pair, were the water was sent through this pretreatment SAP system to raise the pH to another pair of wood and manure substrate and chitin SC20 substrate. And then we used a SC20 chitin substrate as a pretreatment. It's identical to what was used as a regular BCR, but used in the context of a pretreatment, then sent to another woody substrate manure and SC20 chitin blend. So the question came up after we already initiated this project. We got thinking about it and like, well, you know, we have anoxic conditions in this system. There's plenty of electron donors with our organic carbon, and we have ample amounts of electron acceptors, sulfate and iron. We're employing sulfate reduction, so considering inorganic mercury is methylated by SRBs, could we potentially be, you know, pumping out a lot of methylmercury in the effluent of these treatments? And we decided it was an interesting enough question to add it on to the project. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today, is this mercury assessment. I'm not really going to be discussing too much the performance of the BCRs, the metal removal and buffering, as much as I am talking about this supplemental question where we're trying to figure out what the influence of these sulfate reduction systems has on methylmercury, and basically looking at what the effluent impact is. Here's a picture of our setup in the, this big reservoir here is what we filled with the mining-impacted water from an adit that was up the hill, and that fed into a series of 3 5-gallon buckets that were piped into our pretreatment system here, which was 2 barrels, and one of those fed directly into a set of unpretreated barrels. There's 6 of them right here. Here's our camouflage, hiding it from the hunters so they didn't use it as target practice. And basically, it was a gravity-fed system which kind of worked its way downhill from the feeding buckets to the pretreatment barrels to the VCRs. And because it was gravity-fed, we had issues with the flow rate slowing down over the course of 2 months that we evaluated the system. But generally, it worked pretty well, and it was pretty low cost to set up a nice passive system. So after 2 months, we took a look at what's going on with the trace mercury. We just evaluated total mercury and total methylmercury. And here what you can see is the influent of the system is just over 2 nanograms per liter. And the manure barrels all seem to reduce mercury as it passed through. So we have low mercury coming out of the manure barrels here and here. This one was elevated from the influent, but it's also being pretreated by a SC20 chitin blend. But the concerning thing here was these SC20 chitin barrels appear to be sources of mercury to our process, much more elevated than what it's actually receiving. And then we look at methylmercury, we see something very similar. Maybe moderate increases in the manure barrels, most likely due to methylation incurring within the barrel, but pretty significant increases in methylmercury in the effluent of the chitin SC20 barrels. And this influent here is basically the detection limit. So all this is either being generated within the barrel or released. And what we see here in this last barrel, which is basically 2 chitin SC20 barrels in series, is that the effluent of methylmercury is higher than the influent of total mercury. That definitely tells us there is a source within that SC20 sand pea gravel mix that is influencing the effluent after 2 months. And so just to give you a quick overview of their functionality of the chitin barrel, they are all operating as they should be with the low ORP. They were all buffering as they should be, taking it from 3.26 up to, a little over 6. For pH, and sulfide, they were all generating sulfide, a lot more coming out of the SAPS pretreated chitin barrel, but all generating sulfide. I'm not posting it here, but we had fairly decent removal of metals. We're reaching our target for most, except for manganese, which is one of the harder ones to remove. So conclusions of our mercury assessment here, we saw that the manure barrels were definitely sinks for mercury, with the exception of those that were pretreated with chitin and got much more in their influent. All SC20 BCRs increased total mercury and methylmercury. Total mercury increased 10 to 20 nanograms per liter. And if you recall that figure I showed with mercury around the United States, that starts pushing us towards the end in the high range. And definitely for methylmercury, that puts us right on the tail end there of what we'd expect to see in an impacted strain. And based on what I was showing you, what can influence the food web and impact concentrations, that becomes pretty significant here. And the question, if it is sourced from the media, how long would that continue to be a source? How long would it take to flush off the resident load from the media? So what could be potentially contributing to that release of mercury from the BCR? Well, the SC20 is made up of, basically, when they harvest crab, they remove the meat and dry the shells and guts and grind it up. And that's basically with some added protein, that's basically what the SC20 blend is. And aquatic organisms tend to accumulate mercury, and specifically they tend to accumulate methylmercury. There's a chance that some of that mercury load might have been coming from the sand and gravel, and we did not test. This was a kind of an afterthought, and we didn't have any leftover material from this batch. So we don't have a way to confirm these sources in the media, but we know it was coming from the barrel somewhere. And so that's definitely something to look into, is the crab matrix that we were using as our VCR media. So there's, for methylmercury, there's a potential that it's both a release of, you know, preloaded methylmercury on the media, like say for example the crab, or generation of inorganic mercury, both coming in from the influent and potential resident inorganic mercury that's within the system. And based on the analysis that we did, we're not able to differentiate between what the resident methylmercury and internal generated methylmercury are at this moment. That's going to have to wait for a future study. Definitely there is quite a bit of potential for that generation within there to at least contribute to the system because we have active sulfate reduction going on. So now to the lab study. That previous treatability study only lasted 2 months. It was truncated by some problems with adit flow, and we weren't able to continue it because of lack of flow conditions at the adit. But the bench study at the ORD lab, it progressed for 34 weeks, and so they were able to maintain six columns, three of which were the chitin SC20 columns, two were the wood chip manure columns, and then they had one control, which was a sand column. And for one set of chitin and wood chip barrels, they used pre-treated mine-impacted water, all from Formosa, and what they did there was they elevated the pH in the mine-impacted water and sent it through these columns. In the next set, they just sent raw mine-influenced water through, and in the last set, they added sodium azide to the influent to induce abiotic conditions, so that the only thing that could be going on would be chemical reactions and no biological reactions. So this is going to be a nice way to differentiate a little bit what we were seeing in the treatability study. So here for the total mercury results after 34 weeks of operation, we have our results from the raw mine influenced waters. The dark blue here is the influent, light blue is the SC20 chitin blend effluent, and the dark blue here is the manure wood chips effluent. Then we have the pre-treated columns, which had lower influent than the raw. And then we had the sodium azide runs that had quite a bit more mercury in the influent than the other two test runs. And what we can see here is after 34 weeks, we don't see that same source of total mercury contributing to the effluent. Both the SC20 chitin material and the wood chip manure material seem to be sinks for mercury, so their resident source of total mercury seems to be flushed out, and they're operating as sinks. Same with the pretreatment, and same with the abiotic test run. So to summarize there, wood chips, I would like to note that they did not continue operating as a VCR at this point after 34 weeks. They lost their capacity to buffer. They were not really showing signs of SRB activity, yet they were still acting as a sink. So they still had interaction with mercury, even though the rest of their function was pretty much gone after 34 weeks. The chitin sand blend, it was still maintaining its buffer capacity. They were still exhibiting signs of sulfate-reducing bacteria. But instead of what we saw at the treatability study, they were acting as a sink for total mercury. But if we move on to methylmercury, we'll see that, you know, we had very low influent in all three test runs of total methylmercury and dissolved methylmercury. But in the raw, we still see an increase of methylmercury coming out in the effluent. Not so much in the pretreated column, but in the raw column, we still see some sort of contribution of methylmercury to the effluent. And what's really concerning, and suggest that this is an actual resident methylmercury issue is that the abiotic cells with hard, basically non-detect levels of methylmercury coming in, we have really high, over 3 nanograms per liter total methylmercury coming out. And there's no biological activity. And so unless there's some very unusual abiotic chemistry going on, most likely this is still being sourced from the media. And after 34 weeks, it's still contributing significantly to the effluent. So a brief summary of the methylmercury and the benchtop study. You know, wood chip, manure BCRs, they didn't really have much to say. They had no real interaction, low methylmercury going in, low methylmercury coming out. FC20 barrels, despite the fact that they still had, they were still functioning to remove metals and maintain sulfate reduction, aside from the pretreatment barrel, we still see contributions of methylmercury from both the raw treatment cycle and then the abiotic treatment cycle. Now for some general conclusions and recommendations, look at the contrast between the treatability study and the benchtop study. One of the biggest contrasts between the two studies is that in the treatability study, it only ran for 8 weeks before it was prematurely ended because of site conditions. And the treatability study was gravity fed and it slowed over time. So we had decreased residence times throughout the study. So that was inconsistent. In the benchtop study, conversely, we had 34 weeks of solid treatment, and all that was with consistent flow fed with a pump. So we did not get a slowing of residence time. That stayed steady. As far as total mercury differences between the two studies, we saw that after 8 weeks, our BCRs on site were a significant source of total mercury to the effluent with a shorter time period. At the longer time period, we see that total mercury is no longer sourced from the media, and it is moves from a source to a sink. But methylmercury, both time periods, we saw that it was a source of methylmercury to the effluent to levels that are concerning ecologically. And some brief conclusions. You know, we see that the wood manure BCRs, they don't maintain their performance very well with these harsh conditions, but they were able to remain mercury sinks throughout the study, even when they stopped functioning as active BCRs. Inorganic mercury appeared to flush from the FC20 media in the short term. Longer term, that seemed to settle down a bit. And however, the chitin material seemed to be a long-term source of methylmercury to the effluent. And I just want to remind everybody what levels we were seeing in the effluent. We were at levels that basically highest that have been seen in mining-impacted basins. So if we were treating, like, say, an adit discharge that had significant flow, you know, we would have concern with mercury accumulation in aquatic organisms downstream of this unit if this was the case. And presumably, if you run this not long enough, you're gonna blow off the methylmercury resident concentration. But this is, 34 weeks does seem like a long time to run with that elevated of the concentration. So there's a lot of more work to do, on this. This was a preliminary, really quick investigation that we designed after the initiation of this treatability study. So we really need to go back and quantify mercury load and all the material with speciation. That would be a nice follow-up study to any further treatability or benchtop studies. Mass balances need to be performed to determine, like, how long you would have to operate before, you know, this system would stop flushing mercury out. We kind of have an idea for total, but we don't yet for methylmercury. And the methylmercury load from the media prevented the effective analysis of internal generation, because it's hard to differentiate with the study that we incorporated the difference between already methylated mercury on the media and internally generated methylmercury. So we'd need to pre-treat material to make sure there was no resident source to evaluate the internal methylation. And then we see that a minor observation here that perhaps in the future, you know, a wood manure or BCR might be a good polishing step for these if they were to be in place. But with that, I'd like to go over some acknowledgments for the study. The Office of Research and Development, they supported this with their lab study. We had quite a few EPA contributors, Chris Cora, Chris Eckley, Suhail Al-Abed, Kira Lynch, and John McKernan. And from CDM Smith, it was myself, the project manager Mike Allen, Nick Anton, and David Reisman. With that, I will open it up to questions.
Great. Thanks, Steve. We did get a number of questions came in while you were presenting, so we'll take some time here to try to answer those. We got a question on your slide number 22 where you presented some concentrations of influence solutions. And I guess the question is, why were the concentrations varying between the influence solutions?
Well, that is not as clear as it should be, but I believe it had to do with the pretreatment in the use of, like, say, for example, sodium azide that's not, you know, a trace-grade chemical, and so that most likely is a contribution to that batch. And then the pretreatment barrel, they increased the pH, so you could have gotten some removal of co-precipitation of metals with the increased pH in that reservoir. So basically homogenized a giant batch, which seemed to have gotten some contamination along the way because the raw was much more elevated than what was coming out of the adit. They homogenized that, and then they pre-treated the three batches and held them separately. And so they were consistent throughout the test, but they each have their own unique starting concentration, which was kind of nice to see, because now we see what happens with a little bit higher concentrations on the system.
Okay. We got another question. Someone wants to know how common it is to use treatment of mining influence water with BCRs, and then also how common is the use of chitin as a media?
Well, it's really common, and there's a lot of work going on, especially in Montana, of BCR technology. The chitin material, it's a newer idea and been looked at a little bit. I don't know if there's any or too many large-scale applications. It's kind of got a lot of people excited when initial studies showed that it was having a lot more success with manganese removal, because traditional, for example, manure, wood chip, or hay BCRs, the trick, I mean, they can usually get iron down pretty well, but manganese is a tricky sucker. So with the initial studies, they started seeing really good removal rates, above 80% of manganese. And so that's kind of the attraction there. But there's some things to work out, And there's a couple of treatability studies that I know of that went, 2 years, and they see the chitin material kind of burning out a little bit. And, there's this mercury issue that has to be resolved. So there's still quite a bit of work on it before I think it's ready for full scale.
Okay, great. We received a couple questions about using filtered or unfiltered samples. The first one is, I guess someone wants to know, the data that you listed on your slide 12, were your samples filtered or unfiltered? And then I guess as a follow-up to that, to answer another questioner's comment, could you just talk about the importance between using filtered versus unfiltered water samples?
Okay, so this slide talks about the general water chemistry that we observed from 2009 to 2012. This is total data, but it's not, doesn't look much different than the dissolved data. This is coming out of a mine adit. It's all reduced, so most of it is labile, reduced metals. The differences you're going to see is in the effluent of these BCRs, where we did total and dissolved for our regular metals analysis and evaluation of the BCR performance. The trace mercury add-on, limited budget, we just did total to see what's going on with influent versus effluent. You can see the differences that were incorporated in the lab study versus influent versus effluent here. There's the top figure here. Let me get the cursor going again. This up here is total, and down here is dissolved. And you can see that much lower dissolved concentrations. These the ethylene in these VCRs, I mean, looks like black coffee, you know, cowboy coffee. It's really thick. And so there's a lot of solids, and so when you filter it out, you filter a lot of much smaller fractions than the dissolved fraction here. Its implication for downstream could be significant for especially methylmercury, where you know, the dissolved fraction is definitely much more available to accumulate into the food web. But even with the dissolved fraction, we're seeing quite a bit of dissolved fraction coming off these barrels with no biotic activity, which presumably are going to have a cleaner effluent. But even with no biological activity, we're seeing, you know, over 0.5 nanograms per liter methylmercury coming off the system. And so, but yeah, there will be a difference. And so, you know, when you really get into what your impact downstream is, you'll want to incorporate a dissolved fraction. But sometimes the budgets are limiting and you have to pick. So.
Okay. Another question we got is there any concern about BOD coming from the wood chip filter and impacting the effluent? Excuse me, the question just went away. I'm sorry, that question just got deleted from my queue here for some reason. Let's go to another question.
I'll recover that for you and then you can come back to it.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jean. Have you measured the total mercury and the methylmercury concentrations in the column media?
No, we have not. I mentioned that this was added on post initiation of the project, and there was, you know, by the time that we realized that there could be some issues with sourcing, we weren't expecting to see a source from the media. We were just trying to do a kind of a last-minute add-on to see if there was, you know, potential methylation of the mine adit water, and if that was, you know, going through and coming out as methylmercury. What we didn't expect is the source, and by the time we initiated the study and started seeing the results, we didn't have any material left, and it's batch-specific, so each batch you get, it comes from a different source, and so it's not a consistent material. So we don't have original source from this study. Both the benchtop and the treatability study used the same lot number, but there was no leftover unused material after the end of the study when we were starting to ask these questions. And so unfortunately, we weren't able to follow up with that. And so that would have to be done on a future study to try to get a handle on it so we can start doing mass balances.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean, for pulling that question up that I was trying to ask earlier. So I'm going to ask you now, is there a concern about the BOD coming from the wood chip filter and relating it to the impact on effluent quality issues associated with the low DO?
Yes, but that's not unique to the wood chips or manure wood chip VCR. You know, that's also an issue with any VCR, because you have no organic substrate, you're inducing a lot of anaerobic microbial activity, and the effluent on both were very rich in BOD. And so any system that was dealing with a lot of volume and had significant effluent, you were going to have to do some sort of post-treatment step to address the BOD.
Okay, great. Maybe I'll ask one more question before we move on to Todd's presentation. I know you talked about some of the methodology that you used for the measurements that you did, but we got a question just about, you know, how exactly were you measuring the mercury? Like, were you using a direct mercury analyzer?
No. We were, okay, so for 1630 and 1631 trace mercury analysis, you have to have special trace mercury cleaned sample bottles, use special trace mercury clean gloves, and we collected effluent samples. So we had a port on the system where we could flush and then collect samples, and then we also had a port on the tank that fed the system. And so we would collect from those ports using trace mercury collection techniques, sending them to the lab, and in the lab doing the methods 1630 and 1631. A direct mercury analyzer would not have the sensitivity needed to look at the concentrations we were looking at. So direct mercury analyzers use atomic absorption, and they're great for, they would be great for looking at the media, you know, for total, they don't do methyl, but or sediment, but when you're talking about trace mercury in water, they're not an ideal candidate.
Okay, great. Thank you, Steve. I'm glad that we had your presentation, and it definitely spurred a lot of conversation with our audience. And if you can hang on at the end of Todd's presentation, we might be able to get to a couple more questions. But thank you again, Steve. And so now I want to introduce Todd Luxton, who's going to – he's from our EPA Office of Research and Development, and he's going to talk about some work at the Black Butte Mine.
All right. Thanks, Michelle. First of all, I want to thank Michelle and Jean and Diane for asking me to talk today. I'm really excited to share with you some of the results that we've come up with thus far at this at the Black Butte mine site. And so one of the main talk today is going to be on basically looking at how changes in the water level of this reservoir that's downstream from the mine site is influencing the production of methylmercury. So just sort of a brief outline, we'll just go through a brief introduction to methylmercury, and I'm going to cover maybe just a little bit more on the chemistry side of what's going on and some of the geochemical indicators for when you have conditions that are either that are suitable for methylmercury production. Talk just a little bit about the Superfund site itself. I want to thank Chris for covering a lot of that information up front for me, and then really get into the heart of this talk, which is the Cottage Grove Reservoir study. Talk about the reservoir management, methylmercury production, and then just kind of go through some general conclusions and lessons learned thus far. So when we start talking about methylmercury, we start thinking about, you know, how is the mercury getting into the environment, and this was covered really well in the presentation prior to mine. But I, you know, in that case, you know, the example was given of, well, occasionally you do end up with large concentrations of methylmercury that are being released. But typically when we think about it, we think about inorganic mercury that's being released, either from a point source, similar to what you might find with mine-influenced waters, or potentially from a non-point source through potentially like coal combustion. So once you have mercury that's been released into the environment, there's a complex series of different chemical reactions that take place that sort of govern how it's being cycled throughout the environment. So you can end up with deposition from non-source point emitters that are coming into either the landscape or into water bodies themselves. You can have then volatilization back from the water body, back from the landscape itself. But as we're talking about today, we're focusing primarily just on mercury that's been released directly into a water body. And then you get into this idea of having to think about two different components. You have dissolved mercury or dissolved ionic mercury, Hg2+, and then you also have mercury that might be associated with suspended particulate material. And this would be mercury that's being carried down by sediment. So if you're thinking about mine tailings or waste material, that's the mercury that's bound up with that being resuspended and brought downstream. So what can happen then is you can potentially have methylation of this mercury that's in the water column or associated with the suspended material when you end up with anoxic conditions within the water column, or you can have that material settling out on the bottom of your water body and methylation occurring at that time. So as was previously discussed, methylation of mercury is done by anaerobic bacteria, and mostly by sulfate reducers. And to a smaller extent, there have been some iron-reducing bacteria that have been identified as mercury methylators. The other thing to note is that the mercury concentration and bioavailability, only a small fraction of the mercury is bioavailable for methylation. First of all, you have to establish your anaerobic conditions, and then you end up with a series of species of reduced or mercury species, and only a portion of those are actually available for passive uptake and subsequent methylation. So So when we're talking about this site, and this is just kind of a schematic of the Black Butte site itself, you can see up here, I just lost my arrow pointer. Ah, there we go. So this sort of represents the area where we find the actual mine site itself, and you can see that there's a schematic of a furnace, and then also the tailings, which have been actually deposited in Furnace Creek, which is next to the where the actual mine site is. And from there, what we have is transport all the way down through this river system to the Cottage Grove Reservoir down here. And this is about 15 miles away. So we're seeing transport all the way down of both suspended and dissolved mercury. So one of our big questions is we need to understand this connection between the inorganic mercury that is in the reservoir and being transported into the reservoir and the production of methylmercury. And what we're really concerned with is, or what are the variables that are controlling methylmercury production within the reservoir itself, and whether or not the changes in the water level fluctuation are contributing to the production of methylmercury. And we're also concerned then with where is this methylmercury being produced. And finally, looking at what are the sources of some of this inorganic mercury. Are we talking about new releases from the mine, so new material that's being continually washed down Furnace Creek and into the reservoir, or is this legacy material that's already in the reservoir itself? Or are we seeing some influence from atmospheric deposition from the surrounding environment? So to start off, to give you a little bit of background about the Cottage Grove Reservoir itself, this is a Google Earth image here, and what you can see here at the top is where the dam is located. Down here at the bottom is Furnace Creek, which is coming into the reservoir itself. Now, as I'd mentioned, this is a flood control reservoir, meaning that during the spring and summer months, the reservoir is kept at full pool, and that's indicated by this light blue area. And during the fall and winter, the reservoir level is dropped, and that area, the area of the reservoir then encompasses sort of this dark blue area. On either side of the reservoir, near the headwaters, we do have a pretty extensive amount of wetland coverage. And then the other thing to note is that, and the reason that this is, you know, an issue particularly for this reservoir is because we do have fish levels that do exceed the 0.3 microgram per gram levels. But this is a very active and popular recreational reservoir. That you'll always see lots of people out on the water throughout the summer, and there's always a lot of people that are there fishing. Even though there are warning signs everywhere, you still see a lot of fishing. One of the things that's interesting is they're actively stocking the reservoir at this point in time, and they're stocking it with obviously low-level mercury fish. And that's just due to the demand for fishing areas in this part of the country. So, as I'd mentioned just now, this is a flood control reservoir, and so we kind of have to think about this redox cycle that exists. And so I'd like to start over here looking at the spring and summer. And so if you think about it, in the spring and summer, we're going to have first oxygen-rich waters that will slowly become depleted in oxygen. And we'll get to a point in time where we'll start having anaerobic bacteria that either utilize iron or sulfate as an electron acceptor take off. And so you can kind of think about it as, you know, I have this fresh source of iron and sulfate in the spring and summer that's being continually reduced to iron 2 and sulfide. And in that process, we're seeing the methylation of mercury. And so at the end of the summer, you can think about it, if all of the iron 3 and all the sulfate has been has been utilized by the microbial population, we should actually start to see a decrease in the amount of methylmercury that's being produced, since we see a decrease in the overall microbial activity. And what's interesting is what's happening is that we move to the fall and winter, and during this time period, when the water levels have been dropped, we see the reoxidation of all of this sulfide and all of this iron. And so you can kind of think about it looking at this bar chart, where the potential for mercury methylation is going to be highest when we have lots of iron and sulfate that are present, and lowest, obviously, when we've reduced that environment. But what's really interesting is you can immediately see during the fall the change in the oxidation state of these sediments. And even if you just pick up a piece of the material, the reservoir bottom, and break it open, you can immediately see where you start to see reoxidation of the iron, and you still have some of these reducing environments. So it's a very fast turnaround and a quick process. So the first question that we had, and that was sort of the first year of our study, was do changes in water level increase mercury methylation? And for this particular study, we focused on two different locations, one in the permanently inundated waters, and then one over here, then actually three spots over here where we had these seasonal fluctuations, where we had exposed sediments. So we had four sample locations. We were able to collect samples during four different time periods throughout the year, covering the winter, spring, summer, and fall. And what we were looking at was both surface water chemistry for total methyl mercury, dissolved organic carbon, sulfate, sulfide, and then we were also looking at the sediment chemistry as well, total mercury, methyl mercury, organic carbon, and sulfide. So what I'd like to do is first start with taking a look at what was going on in this permanently inundated water area. And that's highlighted by this red circle here. And over here we have a plot, and this is kind of a little bit confusing because what I'm calling this is a normalized depth. Because the water level in the reservoir fluctuates throughout the year, the trying to interpret or try to understand what's happening as a function of depth within the reservoir can be a little bit difficult. So over here I've got this sort of bar chart showing you the different water levels throughout the entire year. And I just noticed that my scale was cut off. And then here we have the normalized data. And so the big thing that I'd like to point out, and then we're taking a look at the methyl mercury production here, or the methyl mercury, excuse me, in the water, is that we see the highest concentrations of methyl mercury during the summer, which is indicated here in the red. And that throughout the year, when we have colder temperatures or when the waters are are maybe more enriched in sulfate and in iron, we have lower concentrations. The other thing to point out is that in the fall, when we have we've come to the end of the season and the water is being lowered, we still do have elevated concentrations of methyl mercury near the bottom. Oops. Something just happened.
Yep, we're going to bring that right back up. Don't worry.
All right. Thank you very much.
No problem.
So when we start kind of taking a look at it from the standpoint of percent methyl mercury that's available, it is important to note that we're seeing the highest percentages of methyl mercury, again, during the summer, which is what we'd expect when we have these conditions where where the bacteria would be utilizing much of the sulfate and iron that's in the system. But what's really kind of interesting is we have these, you know, higher levels of total methyl mercury and percent of methyl mercury near the surface, where we might expect something like that to occur potentially more near the bottom of the reservoir, similar to what you might see here with the percent. So even though we have lower total concentrations, a higher percentage of that methyl mercury is present. Now, the most confusing thing about all of this is that when you take a look at the water chemistry, the water remains oxic throughout the entire year. So we don't see any stratification in the reservoir during the summer. There's also no detectable sulfide that's present. We have extremely low concentrations of iron, too, that are present within the water column and very low DOC. So even though we're seeing this methyl mercury within the water column itself, there are no geochemical indicators that would point to methylation actually occurring within the water column itself. So we're left with the conclusion that, you know, the methyl mercury that we're seeing and the mercury then that we're seeing within the water column isn't being methylated there, but potentially being methylated in another location, most likely from the sediments themselves. So again, we're focusing on these two locations that we were sampling at. This location labeled one here is the permanently inundated, and then we have the three shallow locations, and then we have the data for the sediment cores, and just looking at total mercury present in the system. You can see then we have sediment concentration as a function of depth, and we took cores that were a total of 8 centimeters depth, and they were broken into two centimeter increments. And what you can see that the highest concentrations of mercury are found in the deep pool or the area of the reservoir that's permanently inundated, and we have substantially lower concentrations that are found up here where we have this seasonal inundation that's occurring. When you start taking a look, however, at the methylmercury that's present, what we see is that when we're looking at total methylmercury that within the sediments, the highest concentrations of methylmercury are here in this area that's being seasonally inundated with water compared to what we're seeing then at the permanent location, the permanently inundated location. So what we're seeing here is that these are statistically significant increases, especially for these two points here. So we are seeing significantly more methylmercury that's being produced from the areas that are undergoing the seasonal wetting and drying. But the thing that I'd like to point out here is that this is only really what we're only really seeing this in the top 2 centimeters, and that the rest of the depths in this sort of seasonally inundated area, we're not seeing much change at all. So the most of the methylation that we're seeing is occurring only in the top top 2 centimeters. And this would suggest that potentially this isn't legacy mercury that's being methylated. So we're not necessarily seeing a large degree of methylation from mercury that's been deposited over time and is currently within the reservoir. But maybe more what we're seeing is methylation of mercury that's being continually added to the reservoir as of now. And again, we're showing kind of that same issue here where we're looking at the percent methylmercury. So we're seeing in these seasonally inundated areas, we're seeing a much higher level of percent methylmercury comparatively to the total mercury. And again, the other interesting thing about this is we have no detectable sulfides in the sediment, and we also have very low DOC. So we're still in this situation where we know that we're seeing increased methylmercury production in the areas that are being seasonally inundated. So we have a wetting and drying cycle that's going on that we can see visually we're producing increased levels of iron 3 at least during the dry periods. But we're still not seeing the sulfide, we're still not seeing very high levels of DOC that you would typically see when you're looking at a landscape where you would expect to see high degrees of methylmercury production. So just some general conclusions about our first year study was that we saw minimal oxidation of mercury occurs in the water column, and that's likely because oxic conditions are persisting throughout the year. The majority of the methylation is occurring within the sediments, and the sediments undergoing seasonal wetting and drying do produce increased methylmercury compared to the permanently inundated sediments. So from a remediation implications, if the goal was to reduce the total amount of methylmercury that was being produced, one option would be to limit the amount of water that's drained from the reservoir during the winter and fall. The more areas that you can keep inundated and you can try to keep under reducing conditions, you're going to be able to reduce the amount of methylmercury that's being formed. So that's one potential remediation potential. The other thing is that mostly new mercury is being methylated. Based on what we were seeing, that we're only seeing this production of methylmercury in the top 2 centimeters, which would indicate that if we were able to reduce the amount of mercury that was still coming down the river into the reservoir from the mine site, that we might also begin to see a decrease in the amount of methylmercury that's being produced, because we're only methylating what's immediately at the surface. So if we reduce that concentration, we would expect to see an overall reduction in methylmercury. Sort of one lingering question that we had throughout all of this is, where is the majority of this methylmercury being produced? You know, we don't see conditions favorable within the water column, and we really don't see conditions that are very favorable within the sediments. We do see that there is an increase in the amount of methylmercury that's present, but the conditions just aren't there. So for the second year of this study, what we did is we expanded the amount of area that we were looking at, and we really started to focus in on the wetlands. These areas are both, along with this sort of seasonal mudflat area, undergo the wetting and drying cycle. And so our thought was, you know, even though they occupy maybe 10% of the total area of this reservoir, that maybe this is where most of the methylation is occurring. We know that we're going to have high organic content, so that we know that we'll be seeing, you know, increased levels of DOC. We know that there's a likelihood that there are going to be greater concentrations of sulfate that are present. So perhaps this is where most of the methylation is occurring. So we started to focus in on the wetlands and to try to figure out what was going on there. The other thing that we wanted to focus on was taking a look at pore water. maybe what we were seeing, maybe we weren't able to see some of the changes in the sediment chemistry because what was occurring wasn't was associated with the pore water and not necessarily with the whole sediment. And one of the things to note is that pore water geochemistry can be extremely different from the overall bulk or sediment chemistry. So to try to get a better understanding of some of the dynamics that were at play, we really wanted to focus on pore water, changes in pore water chemistry as well. So as I just sort of mentioned that, you know, pore water mercury is going to be more bioavailable for methylation because there won't be any type of desorption event or dissolution of a solid phase that that would be present. And I also just mentioned that the trends are distinctly different from whole sediment. And the, sort of the other kind of underlying issues is that pore water is going to be more available for benthic invertebrate uptake. And diffusion of pore water methylmercury into the overlying water may actually be the source of some of the water column methylmercury that we're seeing. So quickly, what are we talking about when we say pore water? We're talking about the water that's actually in between the grains. And so this is going to be a very small portion of the total amount of sediment that you might collect in a core. So you're talking about a small volume of water, and it can be quite difficult to try to collect pore water. Over here, there are sort of four techniques that have been utilized in the past to take a look at determining what the relative concentration of different constituents are in pore water. The first one is passive sampling. And passive sampling utilizes some type of a reactive membrane that will equilibrate with the soil solution or the sediment solution to give you a distribution across that membrane. They're great if you have some type of a membrane that will react with your specific element of interest. There are materials that have been identified that work really well with equilibrating with mercury. But one of the problems with using passive samplers is they have to be deployed and allowed to equilibrate, and that equilibration time period could be a couple hours or a couple of months. And without, you know, consistent sort of monitoring, it's hard to figure out where that equilibrium point is. Also, they have to be inserted into the sediment. So if you're in 30 feet of water, it can be very difficult to try to insert a very small probe 30 feet below the surface. The other option is just to use some type of a piezometer. And we had taken a look at this, and it's much easier to insert a piezometer at depth, but one of the problems that you can have immediately, because you're sampling right at that near sediment water interface, is that you can have contributions from overlying water. So as you're pulling water as you're sampling pore water, what you can have is overlying water actually infiltrating and contaminating that sample. The other option is to use some type of a core squeezer. And we had sort of have an example here where we have a core that we had collected. And what we had done is, and what you do is you apply pressure to both sides of that core and try to squeeze the water out of it. But you can see from our syringe here, our problem was is that there were so many fines that were affiliated with these sediments that we found it nearly impossible to try to actually pull water out of it. So our solution was to go with a centrifugation and filtration technique. So what we had done was we continued to collect soil cores like we had, and then we would bring them back to our mobile lab that Region 10 had helped us to develop. And what we would do is separate the cores in under anaerobic conditions, transfer those cores into centrifuge tubes that we would then spin down to separate the pore water from the sediment itself. And finally, what we would do is we'd go through under anaerobic conditions and filter out the last of the pore water. So in this way, we're actually able to capture the in situ pore water, and we were pretty confident that what we were looking at was true pore water that had very little influence of potential contamination. So just sort of getting at this sort of broader idea, what are the wetland contributions? So if you take a look at this figure here, and we're looking at methylmercury nanograms per gram and total concentration, we can see that we're finding our highest concentrations of methylmercury in the wetlands. They're significantly higher than the seasonal mudflats, which are considered here the high pool, and they're also higher than what we're seeing in sort of this low pool or this permanently inundated area. The other thing that's interesting to note is that we finally start to see elevated concentrations of sulfate and iron too in the wetlands. So we're starting to see these conditions that would be, you know, favorable to the production of methylmercury. Just to give you sort of an idea of what we were looking at, this is an average of all of the wetland sites. So we're looking again at the depth below the surface, and we have total mercury, which is represented by the black lines along the bottom. The blue line here is the percent methylmercury, and then the red lines here is indicating the concentration of methylmercury. And just for comparative purposes, I put the total mercury that was found at this permanently inundated low pool site. So you can actually see that the concentration of mercury in this permanently inundated area is higher than what we're finding in the wetlands. However, we're finding that, you know, we're seeing more methylmercury production here. But what's also interesting to note, again, is that we're really only seeing this high concentration of methylmercury in the top 0 to 2 centimeters, which again would indicate that this isn't necessarily legacy material that's being methylated. It's material that's being freshly deposited that's actually undergoing methylation. So I'd like to talk a little bit more, I guess, about sort of overall the sediment mercury dynamics when we include all the sediment samples, the permanently inundated, the seasonal mudflats, and the wetland sites. And we start kind of taking a look at some overall trends, and what I'd like to do is sort of work this back to what we're seeing with some of the pore water. But one of the things that we started to notice, especially as we started increasing the number of samples that we were able to get data for, was we did see this fairly nice correlation between the sediment methylmercury and total methylmercury. And so we saw this nice sort of linear correlation up until a point. And what we started seeing was that at concentrations over 1,000 nanograms per gram of total mercury, we saw that this sort of linear relationship began to break apart, and we were seeing decreases in the amount of methylmercury that was present. And these four locations correspond to this sort of area right here in the map that I showed you earlier. And we started referring to this sort of as the delta area, because this was the area where the influent waters lost the most amount of energy. And you could see that in this location is where we started to see the most amount we could see the clarity of the water begin to increase. So you could see that there was active sedimentation that was occurring. And so I just sort of talked about, we see a decrease in the total mercury does not always respond, you know, in a one-to-one relationship. And again, these points here focus on this sort of delta area that I just mentioned. We saw a similar trend when we started taking a look at how the pore water methylmercury, or the pore water total mercury, excuse me, compared with the total sediment mercury. And so again, we're seeing the same type of relationship. We're up to a certain concentration of total mercury, we have a nice linear relationship. But when we get above that, we start to see decreases in the total pore water mercury that's present. Then again, this sort of starts to, you know, insinuate that maybe there might be two different pools of mercury that we're looking at. Perhaps there's a more soluble and a less soluble fraction of mercury. And again, those four spots, again, relate to samples that were collected in this area. Finally, when you start kind of taking a look at, you know, well, how does the total pore water mercury compare with the methyl mercury, we do see a very nice linear relationship across all of the samples that we took. We no longer see that sort of parabolic relationship where we got it to a certain concentration and the amount of pore water mercury, either methylated or total, was decreasing. So we see a nice relationship. And this kind of tells us that the fraction of sediment inorganic mercury that is available for methylation is in the pore water phase, that we're not seeing a lot of methylation of mercury that's not in the pore water itself. So the last part of this study that we were working on right now gets at the heart of some of the issues that I just sort of discussed. We see this disconnect between total mercury and the amount of methylmercury that's being produced, and total mercury in the sediments and the amount of pore water mercury that we're seeing. So one of the ways that we started to try to answer this question, this is some new data that we've just sort of finished analyzing, was to conduct a stable isotope analysis. So what we had done is we collected samples from each of those three locations, the low pool, which would be the permanently inundated, samples from the wetlands, and then samples from that delta location that I just had mentioned. And so what we did was we added an available isotopically enriched source of mercury. So we added mercury chloride, and we added as an enriched 198 isotope. And so by adding this enriched isotope to these sediment cores, we are really providing the most available form of mercury for methylation. And so what we were doing then is measuring the amount of stable isotope that had been methylated over a given time period. So by looking at the change in the Hg2+ concentration, the inorganic, before and after the methylation time period, we can develop sort of a rate constant for the amount of mercury that could be methylated, and it's sort of a methylation or a production value. So if you take a look at the plot here, what we do see is that, you know, in the low pool area, in this permanently inundated area, we see the least or the lowest amount for potential production of methylmercury. And as you would expect, in the wetlands, we see our highest potential production for methylmercury. But what's interesting is when we start taking a look at this delta area, we do see that the conditions are favorable for methylation of mercury. But the question remains is why do we see this decreased concentration? Why do we see this disconnect in our samples that we're looking at? And it starts to get at the heart of this question of, you know, perhaps there are two different species of mercury or two different sources of mercury that are present. And at this point in time, we're sort of at a standstill. We're trying to figure out what, you know, issues or what questions we can continue to pursue in this area, specifically from the standpoint of trying to address what is the source of mercury. The current thought or our hypothesis is that right now, that mercury that we're seeing in the delta is probably related to mercury that's being transported downstream from the mine itself. And so that's probably in the form of cinnabar or some other type of more calcitrant form of mercury. And so that's why we're just not seeing the pore water concentrations and we're not seeing the methylation in those locations, even though we can show that the conditions are favorable for the methylation of mercury. Another potential option is that perhaps some of this wetland mercury that we're seeing that's being methylated may not necessarily be from the wetlands themselves. Perhaps this is related to atmospheric deposition or runoff from some of the surrounding areas. Cottage Grove is located in a central valley where there's active logging that's occurring on either side, and we do know from previous work that's been done that logging can contribute to increases in mercury concentration within different water bodies. So perhaps we're seeing some influence of atmospheric deposition or mercury that's coming from a different source that may be unrelated to the mine itself. So there's a lot of really interesting questions that we've been able to yet address. And just kind of, you know, some quick conclusions with what we've, you know, with what we've accomplished thus far is we have been able to say, you know, really concretely that water level fluctuations increase methylation. And that it's related to sulfate and iron cycling and recycling. That there's, you know, there's a pretty high spatial variability within the reservoir itself as to where methylation is occurring. And it's based primarily on where we're finding these geochemical conditions that would be favorable for methylation to occur. And we've also sort of identified that inorganic mercury in the most highly contaminated sediments is less available for methylation. So that kind of brings about this question of where is some of this methylmercury coming from in the reservoir? And if you'd like, you can find more information in the journal article that Chris Eckley and I and John McKernan have recently published. We hopefully will have another article that will be coming out in the near future that will touch more on some of the wetland work that we've been doing and taking a look at this pore water relationship and more at some of the stable isotope work that we've been doing. With that, I'd really like to thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great.
Thanks, Todd. Yes, we got a number of questions that came in while you were speaking.
It looks like it, yes.
Yeah, so I think I'll start. There was a couple questions just related to some of the characteristics of the reservoir. First of all, someone wanted to know if you could tell us what the distance from the Black Butte mine to the reservoir is.
It's approximately 15 miles downstream, and it's a high velocity stream for the most part.
Okay. And do you know what the age of the reservoir is?
Oh, it's I was looking at this earlier, and I knew that was a question that was going to be asked. And it's probably, I believe it's about 50 to 60 years old at this point.
Okay, and I guess that same person would also want to know if you knew if there were any tests done to look at the methyl mercury concentrations in the early life of the reservoir.
That I am not necessarily aware of.
Okay. And has there been any comparisons of the results that you're finding in this reservoir compared to any man-made reservoirs that are not influenced by a mine?
At this point in time, I know that some of that work has been looked at in the literature in the past, and I know that for trace levels, they have seen similar types of behavior where you are seeing sort of a potential increase in the amount of sort of ambient background mercury that might be methylated. But as far as I know, this is one of the first studies that's really sort of actively looked at what happens in a mining-impacted watershed.
Okay. Do you know what is the deposition rate in the reservoir, and is it consistent between the mudflats and the deeper regions of the reservoir?
We have not been able to. I mean, this was a study that was focused primarily on understanding where methylation was occurring and what the impact of the reservoir management was. And so at this point in time, we don't have seasonal depositional rates as far as what we're seeing. I can tell you, based on the texture of the soil or the sediment cores that we're collecting, the sediments from the permanently inundated area are extremely fine in nature, which would indicate that, you know, most all of the sands and the silts had settled out prior to that, so that we're seeing, you know, obviously near the dam exit the most amount of fine material. But at this point in time, I don't know if anybody knows what size fraction is most enriched with mercury. Based on what we're seeing with the elevated concentrations in that delta region, I would speculate that some of the larger grain sizes that are being transported downriver, which would be depositing out earlier, is where the majority of the mercury from the mine is coming from.
Okay, great. We got another question. Someone wants to know if there's been any work performed on the isotope fractionation of the mercury minerals, and if so, has that been compared to the isotope fractionations observed in the work that you presented?
There has been work that's been done. The work that I'm presenting is basically just, it's not necessarily looking at how mercury is fractionating in the environment itself from an actual process, but what we're looking at is just trying to use this isotope as a tracer for determining what the methylation rate is. There has been a lot of work that's been done previously looking at, you know, isotopic fractionation due to different processes, and trying to establish specific signatures for different sources of mercury, whether it be from a mine, whether it be atmospheric, or whether it be from coal combustion. So there is a tremendous amount of work that's been done in that area, but that wasn't necessarily the focus of our work at the moment.
Okay. Can you talk about how percent methyl mercury is defined?
Percent methyl mercury is defined as nanograms per gram of methyl mercury divided by nanograms per gram of total mercury multiplied by 100. So generally, you expect to find very low percentages of methyl mercury, since you'd expect to see low numbers that are being expressed because it's only going to be a small fraction of the total mercury that's present. But it is a nice way to get an idea when you're comparing two different sites to be able to look at those percentages. If you're seeing a higher percentage of methyl mercury, that would indicate that there's some process that's at play that's helping to enhance that overall production of methyl mercury.
Okay. I've got a question about temperature. Where does the temperature of the sediments and water rank in terms of its role in the methylation potential compared to other geochemical properties?
The temperature throughout the water column is fairly consistent. So we weren't necessarily seeing a large difference in the temperature from the surface to the bottom of the sediment water interface at the bottom. So I don't think that there's a large role the temperature is necessarily playing in the process.
Okay.
Since we don't actually see any type of thermal stratification throughout during any time period of the year.
Okay. Another participant would like to know if you could describe more about the methylation of mercury 2+ by SRB bacteria.
Well, I'd sort of given that sort of I showed a slide here early on that it showed let me hop back through these slides here. So if you're looking at, you know, what is the methylating bacteria, what are the species that are being methylated by bacteria, these are the two most predominant. I am not a microbiologist by any stretch of the imagination, so I would be highly suspect of, or be, anything I say about how mercury is actually methylated by sulfate-reducing bacteria would be highly suspect. It's just an area that I'm not as familiar with, more the geochemistry. So the actual production of methylmercury by sulfate-reducing bacteria, I'm not familiar with what the exact mechanisms are. More along the lines of what specific forms of mercury are available for uptake, passive diffusion into the cell, and then production of methylmercury.
Okay, thank you. Another person is wondering if you could clarify if the delta area experiences similar wet-dry cycles as the wetlands, and if it's different, they're wondering if that is a potential contributing factor to the differences in methylmercury production. And then they go on to say that if the ore was processed at a mine site, there's very likely labile mercury discharging off-site that would have 15 miles to be sequestered.
Yes, the area that we sampled within the delta did undergo the same wetting and drying conditions that you would see further down within the mudflats themselves. Could you repeat the second part of that question, Michelle?
Sure. They're wondering if it is different. They're just wondering if that's has a potential for contributing to differences in the methylmercury production.
It's under the same type of conditions as the mudflats, but that sort of delta region really is different because, I mean, it's receiving a significantly more of a sediment load that's coming out especially during full pool, because one of the things that I wasn't able to show is during the low pool or during the winter, there's a much stronger channel that cuts through to that permanently inundated location. Let's see, I'm trying to advance the slides here. Let's see. There we go.
You got it? Okay.
Yeah. So during the during the fall and winter, when you just have this this smaller location that's inundated, there's a fairly strong channel that exists that runs down through here and kind of meanders back and forth. So the delta area that we're talking about, we were sampling alongside of. And so you can think that, and it's a great question, because it'd be interesting to note that because of the fact that during high pool, this is where the creek loses, or the contributing river really loses all of its energy when it hits this delta region, because then you're kind of rushing up against the full, you know, volume of the reservoir, and that flush of water that's coming down really slows down, and that's where you really start to see the sediment drop out. So it's a really interesting question, because I'd be very interested if we see a similar type of behavior that might exist down here, where, again, if you allow this sort of stream to continue down, and then as it hits the low pool, or this sort of permanently inundated, if we see a similar type of behavior, where as the water enters this and it really begins to slow down, you really start to see sediment drop out of the water, if you would see the same type of conditions that would persist there as well.
Okay, great. Steve Dent, are you still on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
I see that you submitted a question for Todd. I was wondering if you would want to ask that to him directly.
Yeah, sure. So, Todd, looking at some of those figures, and maybe I missed it, but if you looked at the possibility that some of that decreases in methylation at higher total mercury concentrations related to those enzyme clusters, MER-A and MER-B operons that are triggered at higher total mercury concentrations?
Could you say that one more time? I'm sorry, you kind of broke up a little bit.
Yeah, what's considered the MER-A and MER-B detoxification mechanisms that get triggered in microorganisms at high total mercury concentrations. Mm-hmm. That mercury paradox, where they find sometimes in highly contaminated mercury sites, you know, you don't see the corresponding increase in methylmercury in the food web due to that detoxification, where you know, one cleaves the methyl group off and the other one can actually reduce inorganic mercury to elemental mercury to help detoxify the system.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a consideration you gave in any of this?
Well, let me see here. Oh, here we go. it is, but I mean, it's definitely a consideration and something that we've sort of batted around. But I don't think that we're really not dealing with exceptionally high concentrations of mercury here. I mean, you know, I mean, we're dealing with, you know, 800 nanograms per gram, or 800 parts per billion, you know, 0.8 parts per million concentrations of total mercury. So it's not that these concentrations are exceptionally high that I think you would see something like that triggered. We're relatively speaking, for a contaminated or a mining impacted reservoir, it doesn't necessarily look like a mining impacted reservoir from the amount of total mercury that's present. So I think that's an excellent point, and it's something that we'll definitely have to take a look at. But I don't think it's something that we focused on immediately, because we weren't seeing these very high concentrations of total mercury that were present in the sediment.
Okay.
Okay, we have a couple more questions that have come in. If you guys are willing to hang on a little bit longer, we can keep going through them. So how does methylmercury from the poor water compare with the methylmercury from the permanently inundated areas?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. I guess perhaps the questioner can try to clarify that. In the meantime, let's see what other questions we have here. Someone wrote in, could the saturation of the upper sediments and the resultant availability of oxygen to SRBs be responsible for the increase in methylmercury at the surface of sediments? They go on to say that others have observed that mildly reducing conditions, such as are observed with wetting and drying of sediments, contribute to the production of methylmercury by SRBs.
And that very well could be the case in this scenario. But we were kind of taking, it's a great question. And that's, it's definitely something that could be occurring in this scenario. One of the reasons that we began to think that there was sort of additional contributions of mercury was just based on the overall trends, and the especially not necessarily looking at just the methyl mercury, but the total mercury that was present as well. One of the earlier slides I had showed was that the total amount of mercury that was present in the sediments was greatest near the surface and decreased with depth. And especially if you take a look at the seasonally inundated areas. So not only were we seeing sort of an increased amount of methylmercury production in the near surface, in that 0 to 2 centimeters, that's also where we saw the maximum amount of total mercury that was present. And so that sort of helped us to lead us to this idea that what we were seeing was sort of a continual addition of mercury to the reservoir itself, and it wasn't necessarily legacy material that was being methylated.
Okay, great. Steve, we got a question that came in towards the end of your presentation that maybe we could go back to that. This person wants to know if you used a portable mercury sniffer, such as the Ohio Lumix for H&S, or to correlate results.
No, we didn't. Those sniffers, you know, they were good for areas where we're dealing with elemental mercury, you know, that is actually actively evaporating. We wouldn't expect a lot of that here, enough to be really detected. We're dealing with, HG2+ salt. There might be a little bit of volatile methyl mercury, but no, I wouldn't consider using one of those for this type of an evaluation.
Okay. And another question had come in. Someone just wanted to know if you could talk about what the flow rate discharges from the Formosa adit.
Yeah. That ranges anywhere from, to low season of 5 to 10 GPM up to maybe 30, 40 GPM in the wet season.
Okay. Great. I just want to let you guys know, we just got a comment from a participant that said thanks a lot for presenting this because it's very relevant to some a mercury site that they're working on in developing their remedial investigation report. So just wanted to thank you guys for your time in presenting this information.
Yeah, no problem.
No, thank you. This is I'm really honored to be asked to present today, Michelle. Thank you.
Great.
If there's any questions, I'm feel free to email me. My email's in the copy of the presentation that's available online here. So any questions regarding this talk today or related to this field, I'm happy to take.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Steve and Todd. And, yeah, their contact information will be permanently associated for this webinar, and as Jean mentioned early on, we did record today's session, and it's archived, and it can be played back in the future. So if you find yourself wanting to look at the presentation again and have questions, their contact information will always be there. So I want to thank you guys very much for your time. I think this is a really important topic to talk about, particularly that we could relate this information to some of our Superfund sites and case studies. So thank you again. And with that, I think I'll turn back to Jean Ballant to move us into the closing part of our presentation.
All right. Thank you so very much, Michelle. I'm going to walk through just a few final reminders with our live audience before we close things out for today. As noted, we do have information sessions like this hosted throughout the month through the Cleanup Information Network. You're certainly welcome to visit the CLUIN website at cluin.org, or you can connect with us on popular social and professional networking sites. We do have a number of RSS feeds and automatic email newsletters that come out, so browse our resources and stay connected with us to find out about sessions like today's as soon as we release them. As noted, a copy of the presentation materials is currently available to download from the seminar resources or links page. I've included direct links in the Q&A to that as well. It's going to be active from today forward, so if you needed to or want to download a copy, you're certainly welcome to do so for your reference. Contact information for our presenters and organizers is also listed on that seminar homepage, so as has been noted a number of times, you can feel free to reach out to those individuals directly. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded webinar, all of these instructions still apply to you. You can still download those slides and reach out to our instructors afterwards if you have follow-on questions. I will take just a moment and ask each of you to share an online feedback form with us and let us know what you thought of today's session, as well as to request confirmation of your participation in today's webinar. If you shared the line with multiple people, and there were well over 220 individuals who joined us from all over the country today, so if you did it as a group at one location, each person can fill out their own feedback form. That link is active from this point forward. So again, you can share that link with those who joined you. If you're replaying the recorded webinar, you can still follow those hyperlinks to the seminar feedback and fill out that form. One of the biggest questions we get is if we offer CEUs or PEHs for our sessions. While we don't necessarily issue those exact credits, you can document your participation in our webinars, and many participants are able to earn credit for participating, usually saving a copy of the registration email that you received, as well as a copy of the materials that were presented during today's session. And then when you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check on that form to request a confirmation to be sent to you for your own records. So usually if you do all of those things and save that confirmation email, that will at least document you shared thoughts after the live event, and that's enough to document your attendance. But if you need additional help in verifying your participation, you're certainly welcome to reach out to me directly at balance.jean@epa.gov. As noted, today's session was recorded. It should be released to you automatically via an email in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. And once we do post that recording, you're certainly welcome to forward that on to other individuals who will find this to be useful. Thank you so very much to those 220 individuals who joined us from around the country and our speakers and organizers for helping to put together today's session. I hope that you all found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll see you or hear from you on a future Clueless session. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.